GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Veronica, thanks for that kind introduction. That's me. I serve as host of GreenSense.
And I'm Bob Kessler, your executive producer.
Each week, Bob and I comb the globe, and we find people that are making it a better place to live through their sustainable ideas and innovations.
That is, if they make common sense and economic sense.
And they have to show benefit to the environment. So, Bob, who made the cut this week?
Well, we have Sitka Salmon Share. So the company's founder has an interesting way of selling salmon using the CSA model. He's also a foremost expert on that fish, which, you know, it makes a big difference how it's caught and how it's shipped to how it affects the planet. Also, still talking about water, a lot of really big companies, we're talking Walmart and Hormel and these other huge companies, have made some major efforts recently in reducing their water pollution. So we'll learn about a new report from Ceres, which is a nonprofit.
CSA is Community Supported Agriculture. Now we've got a new acronym, CSF, Community Supported Fisheries. All that's coming up on this week's edition of GreenSense. We've heard for years that eating fish, especially salmon, is good for you. But is the salmon you're eating raised, caught, and shipped in a way that's good for the planet and for us? To tell us more is salmon expert and president of Sitka Salmon Shares, Nicholas Meek. Nicholas, welcome to GreenSense.
Hi, Robert. Great to be here.
You wrote a book, Salmon, A Global History. Give us an idea of how salmon has become the mass industry it is today. And what made it a favorite over other kinds of fish out there?
I think salmon became an amazing global food for two reasons. One, because of the stocks in Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. I mean, this is one of the world's largest wild food biomasses. And just the sheer abundance of these fish provided an abundance of seafood that could feed the world. I think the second reason why salmon became a mass global food that we know today is because of the advent of canning technology. Essentially in the 1880s and 1890s, a bunch of entrepreneurs and innovators set up canning lines from California up to Alaska and started canning salmon and shipping the food all across the world. And, you know, when I first knew salmon as a canned product, my grandma would make salmon patties. And that's how I think salmon became this really important food for most people. Now, since the 1980s, we've gotten a lot more fresh salmon. That's largely a response to and a function of the growth of salmon farming all across the world. And now we eat more farm salmon, and we eat more fresh and frozen salmon than we do wild Alaskan canned salmon, which was the first way that most Americans and most people around the globe ate.
Well, you're an interesting fellow there. You got a PhD in history, and now you're the chief salmon steward and president of Sitka Salmon Shares. How did you become a salmon monger?
Yeah, by accident, like everybody else did. I was teaching history at University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, and had the chance to move to Sitka, Alaska to do some conservation work in the salmon fisheries there, and that was about 7 years ago. And I moved up there and met a bunch of conservation-minded fishermen and decided that I had to do anything I could to stay in this place. And so I kind of left history and ended up working to kind of as a social entrepreneur to develop markets for fishermen who were doing things a little bit better than other fishermen, fishermen that were fishing with lower impact gears, fishermen that were taking better care of their fish and promoting and supporting better handling practices. And that kind of became Sitka Salmon Shares, which today is the largest community sported fishery in the country.
Well, there's a lot of conflicting information about the nutritional benefits of eating fresh salmon versus eating farm-raised salmon. Share with us your thoughts on the subject.
Well, I mean, there are gradations, and I mean, everyone wants to make this about wild salmon and the benefits of wild salmon versus the benefits of farm salmon. I like to think of it as there are a lot of gradations in wild salmon, and there's a lot of gradations in farm salmon. I mean, obviously, we know that wild salmon generally have higher omega-3 fatty acids, which we're looking for. They have lower omega-6 fatty acids, which you're not looking for. Pristine farms, wild salmon caught from pristine environments don't have, you know, the type of PCBs or environmental toxins that they might have if they were caught in less pristine environments. But I will say, you know, that farm salmon is increasingly becoming a better industry. They're using less antibiotics and they're using less hormones. And one of the things that you're seeing are there are some really innovative farm salmon companies that are doing great work in the way in which they're producing, harvesting, and marketing their salmon. So I think the divide shouldn't be seen as much as wild versus farmed, but really kind of digging in there and knowing what wild salmon you're buying, what farm salmon you're buying, and how those fish are raised or how those fish are harvested. And in what environments are they raised and in what environments are they harvested? And if you can go beyond this wild farm dichotomy, I think you can be a much better and smarter consumer.
So you're, in summary, there's a continuum of nutritional value based on those two extremes from wild to farm raised.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think that there are some newer farm raised products that have a much higher nutritional value than a wild product. I mean, obviously, Sitka Salmon Shares only harvests wild caught fish, and we think we're harvesting them in a way that is as good for the environment and is capturing as much of the nutritional value of these fish as possible. But yeah, certainly, I think it's more about knowing the specific practices of that farm or that fisherman. And I think it's about knowing the specific environments of that farm or that fisherman more so than knowing whether that farm, in addition to maybe, than knowing that farm, that fish is either wild caught or farm raised.
Did you just join us? My guest is Nicholas Mink, president of Sitka Salmon Shares, and we're talking about his unique model to catch wild salmon and distribute it directly to you, the consumer. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. Nicholas, there are several ways to catch salmon in the wild, and certain types of salmon raising and catching are better for the environment than others. What are the different methods and their advantages and disadvantages for catching salmon in the wild?
Yeah, there's really three ways that fishermen catch salmon. The first way is on hook and line. The second way, and that hook and line fisheries is a troll fishery, so these fishermen pull their lines through the water, much like you would maybe a bass boat as a sport fisherman. The second way you catch salmon is with the gill net. So these are nets that are set across a river system, and the fish swim into them. And the third way to catch salmon is with a purse seine. So these are much larger nets that the and usually that fishery is prosecuted by usually larger boats. And those and these purse seines have little boats, and they essentially drive a giant net around the salmon, and they pull the purse at the bottom of that net, and then from there they pull in this net into the boat. Generally, the hook and line fleet, when you're looking for any wild caught salmon, your hook and line caught salmon are going to have the least environmental impact on that biomass, and that's really what you're looking for, because hook and line gear is a very selective gear type. meaning that it targets only very specific species. And if a fisherman catches the species that they're not trying to target, they can release that fish back in the wild where it's going to go and live out its life. So when you look at gillnet versus hook and line versus purse seine, you always want to err on the side of the hook and line fishery, really in any fish that you buy at a grocery store, because you're just going to have a much less environmental impact.
Like all things, hook and line sounds like it's much more labor intensive.
Yes, yes, much more in labor intensive, usually more expensive. Every single fish that is harvested on hook and line, those fishermen are baiting every single hook. They're reeling in every single fish, and they're harvesting and processing every single fish individually. So it is an incredibly labor-intensive and inefficient way to catch fish. The benefit of it is it has a much higher quality end product and a much better environmental impact. So here's a great example where quality and environmental sustainability align anytime you participate in buying a hook and line caught product.
Well, Nicholas, we only have a few seconds left here, but I wanted to talk about your unique business model, your company Sitka Salmon Shares, which I enjoyed a sample for dinner last night. Thanks for sending that.
Yeah.
It was delicious. Has brought the community-supported agricultural model to salmon, which is really unique. Basically, for those that don't know, CSA is a way to farmer pre-sells their crop to a community. But you're out there fishing, so give us the elevator speech on Sitka Salmon Shares and why this is so unique, good for people, and good for the environment.
Yeah, Sitka Salmon Shares is a fisherman-owned company, so one of the things that we're really proud about is we've taken the CSA model, and more fishermen have taken the CSA model. There's about 150, maybe even 200 CSFs around the country now. And our fishermen, our members buy in at the beginning of the season, and they can buy in at 3 months, 7 months, or 9 months. And then with that investment, our fishermen go out and harvest their fish over from about March till November. Our fishermen deliver our fish to our own company-owned processing plant. We distribute those fish into the Midwest, where from there they go out to Midwestern cities and now around the country, either through UPS, FedEx, or through our own home delivery service. And it's a great way to know who catches your fish. One of the things that I think we need to embrace more and more in our 21st century sustainable food system is transparency, is traceability, and I think Sitka Salmon Shares provides that.
Well, Nicholas, I'm really glad to know who my fisherman is. So thanks for catching my meal last night. And thanks for joining us on Green Sense.
Hey, no problem, Robert. It's great to be here.
That's Nicholas Mink, President and Chief Salmon Steward for Sitka Salmon Shares. This is Robert Colangelo on Green Sense.
Start Engine has raised millions for green companies selling shares directly to the general public. GreenSense Farms has raised close to $500,000 and Elio Motors close to $17 million. If you need capital for your business, go to startengine.com and start raising the money you need.
With a third of the world's food grown in areas of high water stress, agriculture is the leading cause of water pollution. Recently, seven major food companies, among them General Mills, Pepsi, and Hormel, have committed to do something to reduce the risk of water pollution. To tell us more about it is Eliza Roberts, Water Program Manager at Cirrus, a nonprofit which works with large companies and investors to take stronger action on sustainability challenges. Eliza, welcome to Green Sense.
Thanks, Robert. It's great to be here.
When we talk about water supply, there are two major challenges, water scarcity and quality. What are some of the specific things that growing food can do to water supplies when it relates to scarcity and water quality?
That's a great question, Bob. So as many of your listeners know, there is a finite amount of water on this planet. 97% or so is locked in salt water, and a majority of the remaining fresh water is locked up in glaciers. So this means that there's less than 1% or so of fresh water available for everything else. The food sector is incredibly water intensive. Agriculture uses about 70 to 90% of the world's freshwater resources, depending on how you do the math. And when many consumers think about the role of water in business, they think about the water a company uses within its own four walls or as a direct ingredient for beverage. But the reality is that the bulk of the water in the food sector is used to grow the food that we eat. So we have this finite supply of water that we depend on to grow this food that we eat, and it's being rapidly depleted. We've got a growing global population, more people eating resource-intensive foods like meat. There's a projected gap between global supply and demand for fresh water, about 40% expected by 2030. We've got weak regulations on how water is priced and valued, poor infrastructure that's outdated, and we have many people all over the world who don't even have access to fresh water. And then climate change, of course, is exacerbating all of these challenges. So we've got huge scarcity challenges all over the world, as many of your listeners have heard, particularly with the drought in California. But another key water risk that's putting additional pressure on our scarce water resources is water pollution from agricultural runoff. So this is as fertilizer, pesticides, and manure runoff of fields into local waterways.
You talk about water pollution risk. That's a little bit vague. Can you clarify what that means?
Sure. So water pollution risk is the impacts from what runs off of farms into local waterways and what that means for human health and for the environment. So a great example of this is when you have fertilizer that's running off of fields, which, and this fertilizer has increased by about 500% in the past 50 years. Nitrogen's increased by 800%. And there are tens of millions of fertilizer that aren't absorbed into the fields and then run off into these local waterways. And these lead to things like the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is an area the size of Connecticut that is literally devoid of life. So another source of water pollution, which is a huge risk for companies, and I'll get to that in a second, is manure from livestock. So manure produces billions of tons of waste per year, and when not managed properly, this flows into local waterways, causing toxic algae blooms like the one in Lake Erie that shut down the city of Toledo. So what does this mean for companies? There are a number of impacts. So one is reputational risk. There are huge water quality risks, which then lead to human health consequences. And if a company is sourcing from a region where these water quality challenges arise, people may not be so happy with that company and may not want to procure that product moving forward. There are also huge costs to the company to then clean water that is polluted. So a company may need water at a certain level of cleanliness in order to operate. And they mean if the water utility, either the water utility has to pay for it, or the company may need to adopt new technologies to then clean that water to that level. So there are huge risks for the company, for the environment, and for people.
So let's talk about a few of the examples that these big companies are doing. We mentioned that there's General Mills, Pepsi, and Hormel. They produce lots of products. They use lots of water. What are some of the good things that they're doing to be good stewards of the water?
Okay, so PepsiCo, for example, has committed to improve the water use efficiency of their direct agricultural supply chain by 15% in high water risk sourcing areas, including places like India and Mexico. They've also committed to sustainably source their direct agricultural raw materials by 2020, and then to evaluate progress made against these goals over time.
And how would they do that, Eliza?
Well, there are a number of different ways. So in terms of, you know, improving the water use efficiency, it's a matter of adopting new technologies that will help them be more efficient. And a big piece of it here is also just understanding how much water they are using, how much water farmers are using, how much they're using their manufacturing supply chain, tracking that, and then identifying some really easy ways to be more efficient with that. The challenge is that a lot of companies don't even know how much they're using. And when you start to track it, you can start to figure out some simple fixes that will address that.
You're listening to Green Sense. My guest is Eliza Roberts, a water program manager at Ceres, a nonprofit that's working with large companies on a variety of sustainability challenges. And we're talking today about what these big companies can do to be better stewards of the groundwater and surface water. So Eliza, we were talking about some few examples. Do you have any others?
Yeah, so there are a number of examples I could walk through, but one that I'll talk about is Hormel. This is a brand, one of the biggest meat companies in the world. Many of you buy their pork and turkey products, and they have committed to developing a comprehensive water stewardship policy that sets beyond compliance water management expectations for their major suppliers, contract animal growers, and feed suppliers. And this is really one of the first examples of this that we've seen in the meat industry.
And what is so unique about what they've done?
Well, the unique piece is that a lot of meat companies don't necessarily take responsibility for what happens outside of their own four walls. And the biggest pollution impact really comes from the farmers that grow and raise the pigs and livestock.
Speaking of pigs, was that a pig back there or was that a foghorn from Boston?
That's a great question. Where our office is under construction right now. So apologies for any noises that you're going to be hearing in the background.
I'd add some color to the interview. So go ahead.
Yeah. So Hormel is also going to be engaging with farmers in their high water risk regions, collecting data, setting goals, and improving water quality in these high water risk regions.
These big companies have lots of bureaucracy around them, and oftentimes it takes a lot of time to make changes. And they have corporate cultures that are sometimes resistant to change. Has that been a challenge to overcome change and make these new ideas take
yes.
place?
Yes, most definitely. Water stewardship is a journey. At times, a very complex one. And there's no one-size-fits-all solution for these challenges. Water is a very local issue. So in some parts of the world, there may not be enough water, but in other parts of the world, there may be plenty of it, but the quality will be the challenge. So that's why one of the first steps for a company is to evaluate what the water risks are that they face in their entire value chain, and then use that insight to inform the broader water management response. And there was a report that we released in 2015 called Feeding Ourselves Thirsty, where we evaluated how 35 or so of the largest food sector companies are managing water risk. And we found that about two-thirds of the companies had not yet evaluated water risks in their supply chain, which, as you all know, is where the bulk of their water use and risk lies. But companies are starting to recognize that water poses a risk to their current and future profitability. And we are seeing some real changes and new commitments. And a great example of that are the companies that have stepped forward as a part of the Ag Water Challenge.
And what specifically does Ceres do to help guide these companies in their path towards stewardship?
That's a great question. So a lot of what we do is engaging with companies, figuring out, well, specifically when it comes to water, figuring out where they are on their water stewardship journey and what advising them on what they might want to do next. So I talked a bit about, first evaluating your risks and figuring out where your risks are to then figure out the most appropriate strategy for those. And so as a part of the Ag Water Challenge, we set up a number of different questions that we use to engage with companies to evaluate where they are on this journey. Beyond assessing risks, have these companies developed policies that promote sustainable ag in their operations and supply chain? Are they setting time-bound goals to work collaboratively with other companies and stakeholders in local watersheds that are most at risk? And time-bound goals to engage with growers on the ground. So it's really helping companies think through where they are, what they need to do to both to protect their reputation, but also to protect their bottom line.
Part of this is to support and incentivize farmers and other agricultural producers to strengthen water stewardship. What kind of incentives are being used to support the upstream farmers?
Yeah, so supporting farmers is really key here. If you look at the water footprint of the food sector company, most of it's in the agricultural supply chain. And that means that if food sector companies want to mitigate the water risk that they're exposed to, they have to look beyond their four walls and consider how water is managed at the field level. So farmers are facing increasing pressures to not just reduce costs and increase yields in a very competitive global environment, but to comply with many different surveys and codes from different suppliers. So food sector companies can play a really important role here in supporting farmers in a number of different ways. So this includes providing free or subsidized educational resources, such as hiring an agronomist who can then go out into the field and provide free advising to farmers on how to improve their on-farm practices. And then there are a number of financial incentives, such as favorable financing terms or interest-free loans offered for innovations, equipment, or IT solutions. So an interest-free loan, for example, to adopt drip-free irrigation or to use some sort of online platform that will help a grower understand how much water is in their soil and how that compares to other farmers in a similar region. There are also premiums that can be paid to producers, and then financial guarantees or purchase guarantees offered to farmers who try new farming techniques. So there are a range of different options out there that we're seeing more and more companies start to use every day.
Here at GreenSense, we feel water is really going to be a critical issue to our future. We appreciate what your program's doing, and you'll have to contact us and report back in the next 6 months to a year to let us know how your progress is going.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
That's Eliza Roberts, Water Program Manager at Cirrus, a nonprofit which works with large companies and investors to take stronger action on sustainability changes. I'm Robert Colangelo. This is GreenSense.
GreenSense is sponsored by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, providing a creative and collaborative culture, measuring success by the results delivered. Visit jltus.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of GreenSense. We'll be back next week with more entertaining and informative guests that have made the cut. Who do you have, Bob?
This is our Christmas show next week. So city sidewalks, busy sidewalks. What if those sidewalks were powering streetlights? We'll learn about that. Also, we've been talking a lot about water, but it's a big issue. So desalination has been happening more and more, and we'll learn about how to get the salt out of salt water so you can drink it.
Well, we wish you and your family and all your friends happy holidays. We appreciate you joining us each week, and we appreciate all the comments and accolades that we receive from our great listeners out there. So continue to visit our website, greensensefarms.com, subscribe to a podcast, or view the list of radio stations that air our show. And if you ever need to reach me, send me an email, robert@greensenseshow.com. We hope our guests have inspired you throughout the year. And we, again, appreciate you listening every week. And we know each of you really try hard to make the world a better place. And we really hope that peace and happiness come to all of you for this year and the future. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at GreenSense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow.